Hello and welcome to A Taste of Freedom. I'm Kim Chakanetsa. Over the past few months, the BBC has been exploring freedom and what it means.
I'll tell you briefly. You are with me in this room. If I leave you here and tell you you cannot go outside anymore, then you see your situation. It has a very big impact. Freedom is freedom. You are an intelligent man. You think about it yourself.
We're bringing you some of the highlights, the best bits, if you like, from the Freedom 2014 season. Let's start with America, land of the free. Over a decade since it was opened, the US military prison at Guantanamo Bay has arguably become the world's most famous detention facility. The name alone evokes rows of handcuffed men in bright orange jumpsuits. But what is it like to be one of these men? To live in such a confined space for months, years? How does it change you? In Guantanamo Voices, we heard from some of the inmates who have since been released.
U.S. Assessment of Detainee, March 29, 2004. The detainee was a leader in his community. Detainee claims he is not a member of Al-Qaeda or Taliban.
If you put someone in a prison like Guantanamo, he will be far away from his family and friends. They cannot meet or contact each other. I consider this as death. Freedom. Freedom is like life, like being alive. A free person is alive.
Detainee Assessment, January 7th, 2005. Detainee is an elderly 70-year-old man. He suffers weakness in both lower extremities, attributed to a left-sided stroke in 1990. He will require wheelchair transport to and from the aircraft.
I don't know why they arrested me. They are powerful. They are also enemies of Islam. Maybe our family enemies were behind this and gave the Americans false information.
Detainee Assessment, January 14, 2005. Detainee is not assessed as being a member of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Detainee is the former security commander for Shinwar District in the Nangarhar province, Afghanistan, and was arrested at his compound on the 26th of February 2003.
They frequently tied me and drowned my head in a bucket full of water. They asked me to say, "I'm Al-Qaeda." I told them it wasn't true. I asked, "Bring evidence if you have it." They then took me to Bagram jail and kept us there for 5 months in cages.
Guantanamo Voices. When we think of freedom, it's often in terms of imprisonment, which can take many forms. It may be life in a tiny cell, but it doesn't necessarily mean captivity. Growing up in an independent Zimbabwe, we were constantly reminded that our neighbour South Africa remained until 1994 in a captivity of sorts. Under the apartheid system, the majority of the population was denied its full freedoms by a punishing system bent on silencing anyone who would challenge it. But the human spirit has a remarkable way of finding its voice. Rebecca Kesby talked to choirmaster Lungile Jacobs and singer Siamambe.
Music was very, very critical in the liberation struggle in terms of helping us to be united. It was through music concerts that we were able to hold mass meetings so that whenever the system used to look for us, we were just having a concert, you know, and people would be singing, and in between the singing we'd have hold our meetings, that we were able to spread the message. When there was a problem in a mass gathering, if you want to bring order in a mass gathering, song is the one thing that people would do to then bring calm. You lead in song and people will all sing together. To be part of that mass singing, it is a liberating feeling. So even if you can't sing, the fact that you are there in the midst of that singing It liberates you emotionally, not only mentally. You are able to take out what is inside, the anger towards the system. You are able to take it out.
We're able to escape through the music. The lyrics we articulated on those songs, they will make you want to decide to act. If, for instance, there's been killing, we would sing about the killing, that we are dying without a reason. Therefore, that kind of song will make anybody listening from anywhere to understand and feel that they must also be involved.
African traditional choral singing, I love it because it has a different rhythmic patterns. It has multi-rhythmic approaches. It has different harmonic patterns. There's something about it in terms of what we call in isiXhosa isingqi sakwantu, which is the certain emphasis when you sing. For us, we feel that natural pulse of the song. Where is the rhythm? Possibilities are endless of what you can do as a creative musician.
We grew up knowing that music is a way of freeing your mind and your soul at some point. Therefore, it soothes inside, even if you are angry or you've got a problem anywhere in your brain. If you sing, you get free.
Freedom songs, if you sing, you get free. It's been said that the mind is a wonderful servant but a terrible master. But that's not true of our next two stories from Freedom of the Mind, which show how in confinement the mind can become a means of escape, a form of freedom in captivity. We'll hear from Mazir Bahari, a journalist who spent 118 days in Iran's notorious Evin jail, and from a woman who endured 6 brutal years as a hostage in the jungle held by Colombia's FARC rebels.
One of the most difficult moments of the captivity was when we were in this prison that they had built in the middle of the jungle. It was a concentration camp with barbed wire around us, with watchtowers, with people with machine guns. 4 a.m. before dawn, 2 guerrillas came shouting, "Wake up! You have to number yourselves." So the person nearest to the fence began 1, then 2, then 3, and then it was my turn to say 4. And I thought, no way, I'm not going to play this game. No way. And I remember my heart was beating so hard. I was so scared. And I said, "My name is Ingrid Betancourt. If you want to know if I'm here, you call me by my name. I cannot just let them turn us into things, into numbers. This is not a struggle for anything else in your identity. You have to confront yourself. It's not about the others. It's about, you know, preserving what is important for you."
I had to have some place inside me that I could go to in order to protect myself and protect my integrity more than anything. I was lucky enough to grow up in a very cultured family. I had read many books. I had listened to hours of music. I've watched many films. And that depository of culture was something that's totally foreign to my interrogator. One day, while he was beating me, for some reason, I thought of a Leonard Cohen song. And I realized there and then that Leonard Cohen can be really the gatekeeper to this inner universe that I had kept for myself.
All the sisters of mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on.
Leonard Cohen was opening doors to a world that was very different from my interrogator's world. It was a world empty of any kind of anger, any kind of resentment, any kind of violence. It was a world that was filled with culture, filled with beautiful words and melodies.
Yes, you who must leave everything that you cannot control.
So I not only managed to calm myself, but also I managed to pity him. And that somehow empowered me, because here we were in this dark room in notorious Evin prison, and he was beating me. He was much bigger than me. He was much more powerful than me. But I was the one who was the stronger person. I was the one who was going to survive this much more intact than he was.
Well, they lay down beside me, I made my confession to them.
I always knew that my mind was free, that I'm a much better person than my interrogator. And that allowed me to somehow lie to my interrogator as well, and sometime in order to stop him from beating me, boost his ego and say that, yes, I understand that you're right, I was wrong. If you let me go, I'm not going to do this again. Even when I was somehow degrading myself on the surface in order to protect my integrity, I knew that my mind was free.
Don't turn on the lights, you can read their address by the moon. And you won't make me jealous if I hear that they sweeten your night.
I made many escape attempts. I would say that I was in an escape mode all the time. I never, never, never gave up. And even when I was very ill, thinking that I could die, I thought, well, that will be my escape.
Death may be for some the ultimate freedom, but when death is imposed on an individual, it represents the ultimate denial of freedom. Alan Alt spent years presiding over the execution of inmates in the U.S. state of Georgia as Commissioner of Corrections. This was one of the most riveting editions of Hard Talk with Stephen Sacker.
I still have nightmares, not every night, but on occasion I still have nightmares about it. It's still, it's a very hard pill to swallow, and it stays in your psyche for, I guess, forever.
How did you get sucked into a system to the point where, having been a psychologist, having entered the system as somebody committed to rehabilitation, you ended up as the chief who was signing off on and running a system of death?
In the early 70s, when I started in corrections, the death penalty was unconstitutional. And then it was later, in 74, that Georgia wrote a new law that was determined to be constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the actual executions didn't take place till many years later because of appeals. And the first two that I executed had been on death row 17 years. In fact, they were 17 when they came in, and they were 34 when they were executed.
The 17-year-old that you mentioned, I believe he was called Christopher Berger.
Right.
Christopher Berger's last words to you, just before you gave the order for the switch to be pressed, mm-hmm. were, "Please forgive me."
Yes. I found out as I executed others, some of them even went on to filibuster, you had to cut them off. I probably would have done that too, but his was very simple, "Please forgive me." And
how did you feel at that moment? It was your responsibility to give the order.
Yes, I was standing behind in another room with a glass looking at the back of the electric chair. I was there with the Attorney General for the state of Georgia, and we had phones hooked up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the governor's office, the Georgia Pardons and Parole Office. And so then when he checked with each of those entities which might grant a stay or a parole or a commute the sentence. But when he checked with each of those entities and there was no stay, he indicated that to me. And there was an individual standing behind me who had been my electrician when I was the warden of this institution. I knew him very well. And so when the Attorney General indicated that there was no stay, then I asked the individual for his last, if he'd like to give his last words, which he said, please forgive me. And then I turned to Brad and said, Brad, it's now time. And Brad flipped a switch and we could see the jolt of electricity running through this individual's body, and snapped his head back. And then there was just total silence. And I knew I had killed another human being.
Here is what I find most perhaps puzzling about the real honesty with which you describe your feelings in this first execution. You say you didn't actually even then really believe in the deterrent effect, and you clearly had grave doubts about what you were doing.
Yes.
But you went on.
Yes, I did.
To supervise the killing of more prisoners.
Four after that.
How could you do that? How could you live with your conscience?
I didn't do it well, and I've spent a lifetime since then regretting every moment and every killing.
You don't often hear from people involved in the machinery of state executions or someone prepared to talk so openly about their role. In The Man Who Went Looking for Freedom, Carmen Bogan recalls her family's life in Romania under Nicolae Ceaușescu, after her father took a stand against the oppressive state and a miserable existence characterized by food shortages and police surveillance.
The source informs you that Bugan Ion communicated to Bugan Mioara to bring him his winter coat, two cotton bags, and his vest. He told her to send the children to school and sell everything she can.
When Carmen's father, Ion, decided to stage a one-man protest, it led to him being jailed, but it also meant his family were deprived of their liberty, not because they were thrown into a cell, but because they were kept under daily observation by the security services. More than two decades later, the family retraced their steps and were able to read the banal information the state had kept on them.
My father walks with a shuffle now, white-haired and stooped. But imagine him 30 years ago, handsome, black-haired and full of anger at the food shortages, rationing, at power cuts, the repression of Ceaușescu's Romania.
I am proud for that. I am proud because we made something for human rights, for people, for children. I serve my country, my nation. Yeah.
In the dead of night, he left home, our village. Locked the door, he said, and that was all. He drove all the way here, to the very center.
March 10, 1983, Ion Bugan drove to Bucharest in his personal car after he fixed three placards with hostile words against the government on his car. He drove from Piața Unirii into Boulevard 1848.
Dad's placards read, Army, Justice, Police, what do you defend? Liberty or the Ceaușescu family? He blew a football whistle and scattered leaflets saying, down with the dictator.
I have courage. Not scared me. I was very happy.
He was apprehended by the state organs and kept for interrogations since.
Dad was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
What made him do that? Because he was looking for freedom. He wants to be free, and this is like the price he paid for liberty. He decided to sacrifice his life, and I hate to say that, but our life too.
My mom, Miwara, was in hospital that day with her newborn baby, Katalin. He was dangerously ill, and she was waiting for Dad to visit.
Bugan Miwara is located in ward number 2 for mothers, and her son is in pavilion 3, box 2. She lives in Dragonesht as a housewife. She is married to Bugan Yon. In order to find out certain information about their activities, we decided to infiltrate by admitting into the hospital an officer of our staff, Lieutenant Major Diakonasa Cecilia, together with her child. We will fit her with recording devices, the type TO.
I came home from school in our village that day to an empty house. I was 12 years old, and my sister Loredana, 11.
I didn't know anything. And when I came at home, two men knocked on the door, the front door, and I went to open the door. Two were free men. I think they were free men, actually. And they had black hats, and they had black leather long coats, and these were secret police.
They settled themselves in our armchairs, and they started smoking my parents' cigarettes. They started drinking my parents' coffee. From that day on, they filled the house with microphones. I saw them installing microphones all over the garage, all over the living room. We were ordered to keep the windows, the curtains open, so they can see inside. False time.
TV/S/001072 from 10/09/1983. Number X2, X number 1 at 1MJ. Note. The source informs you that Bugan Miwara has communicated to her daughter Bugan Carmen from the commune of Dragonesht, district of Galați. She is sorry that Carmen has remained home alone crying, but she tells her that everything will pass, and years from now, they will have reproaches to make to her father.
The fall of the Berlin Wall seems like a long time ago, but these issues don't go away, as shown in the surveillance disclosures by Edward Snowden. This is A Taste of Freedom. We'll be back after a short break.
Freedom Live on the BBC World Service.
Hello again, I'm Zoe Diamond, and we're back in the Media Cafe here at Broadcasting House in London. Still to come, we have got the fifth floor here on the ground floor, and here's David Amanor with more.
Yes, Zoe, we're going to be talking about freedom to report and tell a story. You know, the fifth floor is about journalism and journalists, the lives of journalists, so press freedom, a very important issue for us. But we're also going to be talking or experiencing the freedom to sing and the freedom to laugh.
Okay, what does that mean?
It's more about how songs and comedy can be used in protest or dissent. So we're going to make some sweet noise with a live music performance from Monica Vasconcelos of BBC Brazil. She'll have a four-piece band with her. And we're going to get satirically sweaty with a different take on the news with His Excellency Highly Unlikely and BBC Africa's resident president, Kibba King Mad.
Sounds interesting. That's the fifth floor at 21 GMT. This is Freedom Live.
You're listening to A Taste of Freedom. Highlights from the Freedom 2014 season on the BBC World Service. Moving stories and testimonies from people around the world. What does freedom mean? And why does it matter? Coming up, the freedom of women and the freedom of the press, and the story behind the freedom song that became a popular civil rights anthem. That's A Taste of Freedom, with me, Kim Chakaneta, right after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels have unanimously agreed a set of measures in response to Russia's annexation of Crimea. They include the formal suspension of all practical civilian and military cooperation with Moscow. Ministers also agreed to reassess current military deployments in NATO's Eastern European members, the countries which are feeling most vulnerable to Russia's recent assertiveness. The United Nations Refugee Agency says nearly 16,000 people have fled their homes in the Central African Republic in the past 10 days. The UN said most had fled an upsurge of violence in the capital, Bangui, where at least 60 people have been killed. Police in Kenya say they've arrested more than 600 people in the Eastleigh district of Nairobi following grenade attacks on Monday in which at least 6 people were killed. The police say many are thought to be sympathisers of the Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab. The Sri Lankan government says it's banning 16 Tamil groups based overseas as what it describes as foreign terrorist organisations. The groups include the Tamil Tigers and also a series of Tamil organisations that say they do not believe in violence. The Lebanese parliament has approved a law intended to curb domestic violence, but rights activists say it doesn't go far enough. Activists say the final draft was altered so that clauses against forced marriage and marital rape were watered down. Riot police in the Turkish capital Ankara have fired water cannon at hundreds of people protesting against what they believe are irregularities in Sunday's local elections. And Vatican Radio has unveiled an online digital archive, allowing users to listen to the voices of popes from as long ago as the 19th century. The archive, containing 8,000 recordings, was started in the 1930s, but contains older recordings, including one from 1884 of Pope Leo XIII. BBC News.
There. There's that anger.
This is a taste of freedom.
What it means to be me.
Because if we ain't, we're murderous.
I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be.
Countless artists have covered I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, but perhaps none with the flair of Nina Simone, whose guitarist Alvin Shackman you just heard. Candace Peart looked into the song that in 1960s America became a civil rights anthem.
Oh yeah, spirit's moving now.
Of course, you can't talk about Nina Simone and the song I Wish without thinking of some of the great jazz venues in New York where she performed. I'm in Birdland off 44th Street. And there's the glowing stage, and under the soft spotlights, that's where Nina performed in the 60s. And I've come to meet Salamisha Tillett, Professor of English and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, who's writing a book on Nina Simone.
I think the song represents that kind of conundrum or that gap between the yearning for freedom and the yearning for belonging and the reality that racism is alive and well in certain corners of the United States. It's such a tender expression of what it means to be an American citizen at a time when there's a hopefulness on the horizon that maybe this freedom that we've been fighting for can be gained. But at the same time, it also speaks to the long journey that African Americans have had in the United States up until that point to become full citizens.
I Wish I Knew still has a sublime power in its simplicity. It contains a dream of freedom repeated 3 times like a magic spell. In Nina Simone's 1976 performance, it's a wish that is finally granted.
I'm free, and I know it. Don't wanna be here, and I show it. But I'm still free, and believe in me, it's all right.
She knew that in all great freedom songs, it's in the interpretation and in every performance that new inspiration and meaning is found.
Anything I know how it feels to be free.
Freedom songs. I'm Kim Chakanetsa. As part of the Freedom 2014 series, people were invited to send in their images of what freedom looks like. Jacob Niedwitzki and Druti Shah both work for BBC Global News, and it must have been a joy for them to come in every day and find out what people had sent in.
I wanted to get the audience's perspective on freedom and kind of build a picture of what freedom is in 2014. And the best way we thought to build that picture was to actually get people to send in pictures or representations of what freedom looks like to them. So we asked the question, what does freedom look like to you? And we got over 1,000 responses of people sending in images and the stories attached to those images.
Wonderful. So let's take a look at some of the highlights that you got.
Well, one of the really strong images that we got was actually from Hong Kong. A 16-year-old took a picture of another friend of hers, a ballet dancer, in the middle of a street in Hong Kong. So you can see the equivalent of a zebra crossing. You've got a tram in the background, and you've got this beautiful young girl just flying up in the air, dancing, as it were. It's a stunning image. She's wearing her black tutu. Her leg is up, almost touching her arm. It's absolutely beautiful. We saw it and we were just completely astounded.
And it's very striking. I really, really like that one. What about you, Jacob?
One of the other images that I really liked was from someone in America called Danielle. And she took a picture of her boyfriend, who is at this point in time in this picture feels free in America. He's just standing on some train tracks looking at some graffiti in her local town.
Right.
And the reason why she sent this picture in was because this was a kind of glimpse of freedom for him. As an illegal immigrant, he actually can't be in America and can't actually do a lot of things with her. So, for example, they want to do simple things like go to an R-rated movie, so a movie that you need to be over a certain age to watch. You need to be able to prove that. You need to have some ID, and he hasn't got any ID to prove that he's overage. And lots of things like that. They basically can't have the same freedoms that other people can. And she said to us that it seems kind of ridiculous because she's in love with this person, but she can't feel free with him.
What's fascinating is how different those first two images are. The first one is someone who's out and free and, you know, open, and the idea of this quite anonymous and striking image of this guy by himself standing in some sort of anonymous stretch of America, that's interesting.
Well, I think we had a mix of people talking about or showing us pictures of what they thought was freedom, but also what they thought was a lack of freedom. To some people, a depiction of a lack of freedom was kind of a realization of what freedom really means.
Okay, Druthi,
where
to next?
Well, actually, this is a very, very strong image. It's a packet of pills, a packet of prescription pills.
Okay.
And the lady who sent it in said to us that this particular image gives her freedom because the pills stop her from being depressed. And when we read that story, that really made us think. And it's also something that a lot of people could identify with. So you've got a strong, stark, black and white image. You've got a pill packet with just one pill left in it, and the fact you've then got Nicola's story saying this to me is what has made me happy, has made me become who I really want to be, it really had an impact.
I thought actually that was particularly interesting because I think a lot of people might see pills as not being freedom because they kind of tie you into a dependence maybe, but obviously for her it changed her life in a positive way.
And you can see all those images, just go to bbcworldservice.com and click on Freedom 2014. I was struck by a comment in All That Stands in the Way about the lives of teenage girls.
In no country in the world are girls and boys and women and men equal.
Roz Atkins was in London and Jordan's capital, Amman, two cities miles apart, not only in distance, but in values too. While London is said to be a relatively open and free society, Amman is regarded as more conservative. But what does that mean for a teenage girl growing up in these contrasting cities today? Let's start with the experience of Lulu in London.
A man approached me from behind and at midnight grabbed me from behind. And at first I froze, I didn't know what to do. And before I'd be like, oh yeah, I'll fight anyone off that does anything. But it's that moment where you can't. And in the end I managed to kick him hard and he did let go of me. And I got in front of my friend, so he left me alone. And for a while after that, I was a bit scared to go out, really.
And you can understand why. Now, I've not heard Lulu make any connection between that kind of story and watching porn, but her mum, Daisy, does.
I think it's definitely harder to be a teenage girl today. When I was growing up, I could go out when I was 16 or 17 with a group of friends who were girls, out clubbing and drinking, and we'd have a good time. We could walk home together and be relatively safe, but certainly these days I wouldn't let my daughters walk home at 2 in the morning with a group of girls. I think there are far too many scary men out there, really, because of influences from the internet and porn particularly. And I would definitely see a lot of them as predators.
The direct impact of porn on male behaviour is hard to assess and establish, but I can be categorical about what Lulu's experiencing. The day-to-day sexism and misogyny that she's exposed to are continuous and multifaceted. It's a fundamental part of her life, and something this pervasive cannot fail to create long-lasting perceptions about women and men that remain into adult life. Now, Lulu's mum and dad are taking the approach that these issues are best dealt with by her going out into the world and learning how to manage them. In Jordan, Mira's father, Marwan, wants to protect her from all of this. Any parent's love for their children is going to translate into a desire to protect them. And I guess inevitably is kids grow up, they become teenagers. There's a tension between our desire to protect and their desire for a few more freedoms. And what's been interesting listening to Mira's father, Marwan, is that he isn't just concerned with keeping Mira out of harm's way. He's also worrying about her reputation and about his family's reputation. And that's being driven by his community and his faith and how they view how women and girls should behave. And what I've been struck by as I've spent the last few days in Mira's home is that they all discuss these beliefs within their community, not as something which might evolve or can be challenged, but something which is fixed and which they have to live with. Sounds incredible, eh?
Oh, it's nice.
Marwan's brought me to a spot with a spectacular view of Amman, and as multiple calls to prayer cascade down the valley, he explains to me why in Jordan, equality means equal but different.
When you think about freedom for your children, what does that mean?
It means that they can do whatever they want and they like, based on not to break the law, first of all, not to break the traditions, not to break any religion laws. This is the freedom. Any freedom have limits.
When I see the way that Mira is living, there are lots of things that she can't do that a 15-year-old boy could do. She can't...
Like what?
She can't meet with friends without your permission.
And she can meet her friends, but I have to know the family. I will not allow for her to do anything she wants. I do care about her reputation. I do care to give her the right direction in our religion, our traditions, our habits, and I would like the best for her.
But do you accept that your concern about reputation, your love for them, your concern that they spend too much time with the wrong people, are those things preventing you from allowing them to be equal to men and boys the same age?
Yes, yes, for sure.
So actually it's more important that they're safe, that they have a good husband, that they have a secure home. That's more important than whether they're equal to men and boys.
Right. In our country, in our traditions and culture, I think men's in general, they don't like a liberal family or liberal woman. They want a conservative lady or woman or wife because they feel more trusty with her. They feel that she doesn't have a love relation before. She will give more attention and care and love for her future husband.
It seems like it's a woman's lot to suffer discrimination, young or old, single or married. Southeast of Delhi is the Hindu town of Vrindavan. It's known locally by a different name, the City of Widows, a reference to the thousands of widows who pour into the city every year. In Freedom to be Single, Rupa Jha looked at the plight of these women who find themselves living in this temple town, not by choice, but by circumstance.
It's a city of narrow, crowded alleyways and shrines and holy baths, where the devoted purify themselves. And the sanctuary offered here has attracted some 15,000 women whose grief at losing their husbands has been compounded by what followed. often seen as a burden emotionally and financially by their families, they have suffered resentment, abuse, and ultimately abandonment. One of them is Shakti Dasi.
Shakti Dasi? Shakti Dasi ma?
She's 65 now and came to Vrindavan 8 years ago after life as a widow living with her family became unbearable. She lives in a small brick shack in a compound, impoverished and alone.
When my husband was alive, I had his protection. But then he died and I was left like an orphan. My sons and daughters-in-law just didn't care about me anymore. They hurt my pride and my self-respect. I said to myself, I don't want to see their faces ever again. Whenever they abused me, I felt very, very sad, of course. I'd start crying. There was no one left for me. There was no point for me even to be in this world. I came into this life as a queen, but now I've been reduced to a beggar.
She's saying at the moment the husband died, she was hit badly, her legs were broken, her daughter-in-law, her sons, nobody treated her like a human being. So she didn't feel that she was leading a life of dignity. I'm very ashamed, actually. I feel ashamed, absolutely. I don't have words to say how I feel.
Shakti Dasi's story hit me hard. Of course, I knew before meeting her that life for Indian widows can be tough. But I was shocked to see firsthand how, without a man by her side, our society and her family see her as worthless.
So little has changed for women in this country. Look around, 1.26 billion people in this country, and you know that a big chunk of that population actually has to fight for a dignified life. And being a part of that gender, I feel very strongly. I think we have not moved enough as a modern society.
We may not always like the press, but one of its duties is to serve as a guardian of freedom. But let's for a moment spare a thought for journalists working in places where a press pass can mean you're viewed with hostility. This could describe a number of places today: Ethiopia, Russia, Pakistan, or as the BBC's Celine Girit found out, her native country, Turkey.
The demonstrations, which started in central Istanbul over the fate of a city park last summer, showed continuing divisions in Turkish society. The conflict burst onto social media. One Twitter user accused a journalist covering the demonstrations of being a foreign spy. The reporter was committing treachery to her nation. A storm of abusive messages followed. The man who sent them wasn't any old teenager with a smartphone. He was a powerful politician, a member of the governing party, the mayor of Ankara. And the reporter he targeted was me. I had been sent by the BBC from London to cover the protests. In a speech to his party MPs, the Prime Minister took time to single me out.
How can a person be involved in such a conspiracy against their own country? Can this be called journalism? Can this be called press freedom?
It was my reporting from another Istanbul park that attracted official condemnation.
When the main protests in Gezi Park were broken up, people started gathering in their local parks, like this one. I used to live close to here, and my grandparents would bring me to this park when I was a kid.
At one protest here, I wrote on social media about what the speakers were saying. One woman called for an economic boycott for 6 months to get the government to listen. I quoted her in a tweet. Afterwards, the mayor of Ankara ascribed this woman's words to me, as if I had called for a boycott. The mayor launched a Twitter campaign against me, calling me a British agent and a traitor. Thousands of other people sent abusive messages, including rape and death threats. The mayor took his campaign onto television.
She is called Selin Girit, and this is her tweet. Let's say a provocateur comes and shoots the BBC's Turkey correspondent in reaction to what I did. It could happen. She could be shot just to stir up Turkey. She is not an innocent woman.
I've made repeated requests to several government ministers and the Prime Minister himself for interviews to let them have a chance to defend their case, their position. But none of them, it seems, are willing to talk. And it feels like the government is ready to criticize journalists, but not as willing to answer direct questions.
Media censorship is still very much an issue in Turkey today, with attempts to ban Twitter and YouTube. And elsewhere too. In Europe's troublemakers, Ukrainian opposition journalist Tatiana Chernovil suddenly found herself the subject of the story. She was chased and attacked one night after covering the protest in Kiev, which led to the fall of President Yanukovych. What makes this piece with Lucy Ash especially gripping for anyone listening is that the action was recorded on Tatiana's dashboard camera. A precaution taken because something like this might happen.
The soundtrack alone is chilling. She's on her own, it's late at night, and a black Porsche is trying to force her small car into a ditch. She desperately tries to escape, weaving in and out of the hard shoulder.
I said to myself, Tanya, hold the wheel straight, stay on the road. But this car that was ramming me probably cost $40,000. And I realized that if such an expensive car is deliberately smashing into me, it means that those guys are being paid a lot to kill me.
Eventually, her battered car ground to a halt, and men in tracksuits jumped out of the Porsche four-wheel drive. Tatiana got out of her car and started running.
Some came after me on foot, but the others tried to hit me with the car to run me over. And the last thing I remember is jumping out from under the Porsche's wheels before I blacked out. I lost consciousness, but after a while I came to. I remember standing on my feet. I was being held up, but...
You managed to stand up?
Or I was lifted up. I don't know. I don't remember anything. I just remember that I was standing on my feet. Someone was supporting me and someone was beating me. I could feel the blows, and with each blow, I could feel my face being smashed. I could feel my nose breaking. They left me in the freezing cold under a tree. So I was very lucky, actually, that the police saw my abandoned car in the middle of the Borispol highway and then found me, or I'd have just frozen to death. When I was taken to hospital, my lungs were full of blood.
One of Chernovil's eyes is still red, and she wears a protective metal guard over her nose, but she's recovering well, despite frequent dizzy spells. Pictures of her swollen face shocked the world and further angered the protesters in the square. They'd been there for weeks, ever since the Ukrainian president decided to abandon closer ties with the European Union in favor of Russia. While Titania was in hospital, the demonstrations became bloodier and more confrontational. Sviatoslav Chomenko, a colleague from the BBC's Kiev office, shows me the protesters lined up against the police just off the main square. It's hard to hear him over the sound of the stun grenades fired by the police.
Now we are on the border of the clashes.
We can see a whole crate of Molotov cocktails that are ready to be chucked at the police. You can really, the smoke is really making me cough. You can really smell the petrol as well.
I guess it's even a bit more safe here because gas goes lower.
Oh, yeah.
So here is the gate of the Dynamo Stadium where the most violent clashes take place.
You can only just see the columns through the smoke.
Perhaps you can only really understand what freedom is when you no longer have it. We've heard from former Guantanamo detainees, as well as a widow in India. And we'll end in Argentina, where a decade of violent military rule in the 70s and 80s cast a long shadow over the country. Many, including the generation that followed, found great solace in songs about freedom. The BBC's Natalia Kosoy was one of them.
Many musicians and singers that I love have had to spend time abroad because of the music. The composer Teresa Parodi believes that Argentinian artists and their music, all musicians, have an enormous resilience, and it's a resilience they pass on to their audience through the music.
Dictatorships try to destroy the singer, but songs never die. This is where their power lies. They live within us. They survive. Tantas veces me mataron. There's always someone who will stand up and sing.
But if you ask me which song is at the top of my playlist, it has to be Mercedes Sosa singing Como la Cigarra. It is so simple and yet so deep. In the time of shipwrecks and darkness, says the song, you will be rescued. And then you will be free to go on singing. There is this theory that silence was a sign of danger for early humans. So they filled it with sounds and then music. Every song in this playlist did just that for us in Argentina. It helped fight fear in a country that was changing, evolving towards freedom. A bit like the cicada, emerging from its silent, dark hole beneath the earth to sing in the open air.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Kim Chacaneta. The producer was Mark Savage. For more of these programmes, go to bbcworldservice.com and click on Freedom 2014. The BBC.